I'm Ann Strange Champs, and this is To the Best of Our Knowledge. Do you remember the first time you fell in love with a piece of music?
I think back to my first introduction to jazz, and it was really a life-changing moment for me. I was in high school. I went into a jazz club, the Lighthouse. It's down on the beach near Los Angeles. And literally within the first 20 seconds of hearing the music, I said to myself, this is it. This is what I've been looking for. And ever since then, my life has been changed by that introduction to jazz.
This is jazz critic Ted Gioia. And what he says reminds me that we all have these seminal jazz moments, like the first time you heard A Love Supreme, or finding out how cool Miles Davis was, or taking a maiden voyage with Herbie Hancock. And for me, I don't remember a time when jazz wasn't part of my life. My dad was a professional jazz musician in New York City, and from the time I was born, jazz just permeated my childhood. I can remember lying in bed and hearing this recording, or something kind of like it, playing somewhere in another room, and it would feel like waves of sound were rocking me to sleep, like floating in an ocean. But somewhere along the way, people started talking about jazz as an artifact.
There's an attitude prevalent in jazz nowadays, and it's one I've got to say I think is so bad for fans and for the music, and it's this idea that jazz is a kind of nutritional supplement, or it's a kind of vitamin. You listen to it because it's good for you. And to my mind, that completely negates the reason I came to jazz, and the other fans I know, the reason they came to jazz is because of just that visceral excitement of hearing it.
Today on To the Best of Our Knowledge, jazz is dead? Long live jazz. Ted Gioia, hit it.
To me, the most exciting thing happening in jazz right now is this new dialogue between jazz and popular music in ways that no one ever expected. You know, David Bowie, right before he died, did a jazz album with the very best jazz musicians in the world, and it became a huge seller. And then Prince, right before Prince died, was doing these concerts with just piano accompaniment, and he was working on a jazz album. And then you see Lady Gaga hiring Tony Bennett, or you see Kendrick Lamar, the rapper, using Kamasi Washington and these great jazz musicians. I see this over and over again. The most visionary people right now in popular music are turning to jazz. I think we are at the early stages of this, and I do believe that over the next 5, 10, 15 years, you're going to see a blossoming of jazz.
So what's the appeal of jazz for big pop stars? You know, like you mentioned Kendrick Lamar, David Bowie, Prince, Lady Gaga. What is it that draws them to jazz?
The music world is in crisis right now. The people running the labels don't like to talk about it, but if you look at the revenues in the music industry, they've been declining since the last century. And what they need right now, I believe, is exactly what jazz has to offer. A visionary approach to music, a creative rule-breaking, a way of getting out of formulas. The music industry is in a rut. If you listen to the radio stations, you hear the same 15 songs over and over again. I really think the music industry right now is similar to the way it was in the early 1950s. In 1952, 1953, nobody could have predicted Elvis and rock and roll, but everybody could hear that sameness, that boring repetition in the music, and they knew that something new was going to come. I think we're in the same situation right now. And I don't believe jazz on its own is the answer, but I believe jazz is part of the solution.
You've said that the first and most important ingredient in jazz is its ecstatic rhythmic quality. What does that mean, ecstatic rhythmic quality?
You know, I wrote my book on how to listen to jazz, and with great trepidation did I approach the opening pages because I knew how difficult it was to define and describe the ingredient that I think is most essential to jazz. And that's that magical rhythmic cohesion between the different performers. That way the bass player and the drummer and the piano player and the horn player, the way they blend together, and there's sort of a give and take. There's nobody that's really the leader, but everybody is able both to express their individuality, their personality, and still blend in with the other performers. Some people call that swing, and I think that's part of it. But when I hear that beautiful blending together of all the musicians in this wonderful rhythmic process we know as jazz, I find it exhilarating. It is ecstatic. And for me, that's the very first thing I listen to in any jazz performance.
For example, pick an album, something new or something old. Think of a track, and then tell us how to listen to it and what to hear.
A handful of recordings have changed how I listen to music. And one that comes almost at the top of the list is a live recording Bill Evans did in 1961 at the Village Vanguard with his trio, with Scott LaFaro on bass and Paul Motion on drums. And there's a certain tragedy around this recording because a few weeks later, Scott LaFaro died in a car crash. So this is really the last recording of this great band. And they did a version of My Foolish Heart, which really is a touchstone for me of musical greatness. First of all, it's the dialogue between the different musicians. And you don't hear the bass and drums accompanying the piano, but really entering into a give and take, a free-flowing dialogue that I had never heard before when I first experienced this recording. The other aspect of it I call attention to is how amazingly slow it is. If you had any more time between the beats in this music, you might think there was no rhythmic pulse. And so it's, at the time, it was perhaps the slowest jazz ballad anyone had ever recorded. And so I like to introduce jazz fans to this because, first of all, it shows great jazz doesn't have to always be fast and swinging. It can still have this wonderful rhythmic propulsion, even at a very slow tempo, particularly this one, maybe the slowest of them all.
What is it that sets a great band or a great musician apart, a jazz musician? I mean, what is it they can do that, you know, the second-tier players can't?
At the very top level of jazz, all the techniques, all the book learning, all those rules of harmony are thrown by the wayside. There's a certain level you reach in which you no longer have to think through the names of the chords. You never have to think through the substitute scales. You never have to think back to what you were working on in the practice room because they're such second nature to you. And that next tier is less a technical challenge. It's an emotional, psychological challenge and a battle for authenticity of putting your own personal stamp in the music. And when I hear the very great players, that's the level they're playing at.
Is it partly that they can hear the whole song, the whole piece all at once, as well as, you know, all the tiny little individual decisions and notes?
Some people tell me that great jazz musicians can think ahead, that they're thinking 5, 10, 20, 30 seconds ahead while they're playing. I don't believe that for one moment. I believe that greatness in jazz is to immerse yourself completely in the immediacy of that present moment. And when you get into that state, the music seems to play itself. It's almost as if someone else is playing the music for you when you're performing at that level. And this is controversial, but I think this is the reason why so many jazz musicians have had drug problems. I believe that their whole professional existence is about these intense, ecstatic moments in which they are fully invested in that moment. And what do you do when the music is over? What do you do when you leave the club? You go home. It's great for the music, but also I do think there's this jazz personality. I think it does have destructive elements.
Well, you're a musician. Is there a piece of that that's true of you too?
Well, I think all of us that play jazz get a high from it. I mean, I have felt it on occasion, but you know, even more, I recognize it when I hear other people playing jazz at that super high level. I don't think any other genre of music creates that same kind of tightrope act of you going out there in the performance and not knowing beforehand what's going to happen.
Do you think the audience can get a little contact high, you know, a hit of that ecstasy? Does jazz have a psychological effect on listeners?
I've experienced it in the nightclub, and I've seen other people experience it as well. it almost becomes a kind of ecstatic cult or a ritual experience. And afterwards, you try to describe it to someone who wasn't there, and you can't. Mm. You just can't. But there's a certain energy goes through the audience. Now, not every time. This doesn't happen every night at the jazz club. But talk to any jazz fan who's been listening to jazz live for more than 5 or 10 years, and they will all have these experiences in which something happened on a specific evening, and they'll just say, oh, I wish it was recorded. I wish I could go back there, because it's this living in the moment that the jazz experience at its highest level can convey. That's the number one reason why I tell people to listen to jazz. You will hear something tonight that will never happen again. And that's rare in any culture, in particular in our musical culture today, where so much is built on repetition and formula.
We started by talking about new directions, new vitality in jazz. Who's out there who's really exciting you right now?
Few musicians have me more excited than Kamasi Washington, a young sax player from Los Angeles. Washington's probably best known for performing with rapper Kendrick Lamar, and this given him visibility among people that normally don't pay attention to jazz. But those folks really need to seek out his album, The Epic, which is an extraordinary work. It's 3 albums, and what Kamasi does on this is he brings a jazz band and a string orchestra and voices and blends it all together in one of the most ambitious projects I've heard in years. Just hear how he is able to have such a big vision of his music. And you just get a sense that even today, in the new millennium, you can have people that have big visions of jazz. It's not just something they learned out of a textbook in school or codified in some sort of teaching method, but really aim for the fences. You know, it's like one of those baseball players trying to hit a home run. And that's what I hear when I hear Kamasi Washington play nowadays.
Ted Gioia is a jazz critic and historian. His new book is called How to Listen to Jazz. And this is Kamasi Washington's 7 Prayers. Coming up, we'll talk with 2 of the most innovative jazz artists working today, Esperanza Spalding and Vijay Iyer. I'm Ann Strainchamps. It's To the Best of Our Knowledge from Wisconsin Public Radio and PRI, Public Radio International.